Accession number 17894, Reel 1.
This is an interview with Andy Sefton, Chief Test Pilot of Rolls-Royce, recorded by Rodney Giesler for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive in Bristol on the 22nd of January, 1998.
Yes, I'm off mic, but I'm picked up all right.
Yeah, okay.
Anyhow, Andy, can you just describe me what is your posting, what is your job at the moment?
Current job at the moment is head of flying for Rolls-Royce Military Aero Engines Limited. It used to be called Chief Test Pilot, and found that's the job that I do, but the company describes it as head of flying. So I normally describe myself as head of flying. People say, "What's that?" I say, "Chief Test Pilot." They say, "Ah, okay, fine."
Now, you presumably fly all aircraft that are fitted with Rolls-Royce engines, do you?
The intention is yes. I was employed to test fly fast jet airplanes for the company, because they then tested their own product in fast jet machines. Essentially, at the time, it was the Harrier. But the company policy at the moment is to do the minimum of flight testing. The engines are certified on the test bed and then put straight into the machine on which it's intended that they shall fit in the end. And the customer does the demonstration flying or the certification flying. So there's very little flight testing that actually goes on there.
So do you fly aircraft when you do fly at both ends of the performance spectrum, from the Eurofighter to the Airbus, for instance?
I fly both ends of the spectrum, but it's aircraft of the I think the earliest aircraft to fly is a 1909 Blériot. The most modern machine I'm flying at the moment is an HS-125. The last flying I did for Rolls-Royce was 3 years ago in a Harrier in the States. The next flying I'm going to do will probably be the re-engineering of the Jaguar and a modification to the engine on the Hawk, which will occur in a couple of years' time. But my current flying, I don't fly on a regular basis for Rolls-Royce. I stay current by flying an HS-125 and a BAE-146 for British Aerospace. I fly the company Spitfire, which is a Mark 19, used to belong to Battle of Britain Flight. I operate a Spitfire at a Gloucester, which is a Mark 9, and I'm chief pilot for the Shuttleworth Collection, which has got about 32 aircraft at the last count that fly from the 1909 Blériot up to the 1944 Spit.
I want to talk in detail about that, if you wouldn't mind, later on, but I think perhaps we'd better start at the beginning. When were you born?
Born January 13th, 1950. And before you ask, it was a Friday in Coventry. That's all I can say about that.
And were your family flying? Or
no, not at all. It's an interesting history, that. I never really come to the bottom of it. My mother's father, who died in 1940, so I never knew her, was a corporal in the Royal Air Force. He ran away from school and joined the army. He was underage and sent home. This is in the 1914-18 war. Did the same, joined the Navy, and he was sent home and did it for a third time and joined the Air Force. And they left him because they knew he was a lost cause. And so he eventually died in 1940. But that's the only connection that I had with flying within the family. Families are essentially boat builders on the Coventry Canal. Half the family built boats and the other half owned the pub, and ended up as a nice partnership. The pub still exists, so they're the boat building firm, and it's still in Sefton hands. The boat building firm went bust in the 1920s. My father was a toolmaker, grandfather was a carpenter, but nothing to do with aviation. Although there is nothing other than aviation that I was ever going to do in my life. I can't remember ever considering doing anything else. We lived, or my family lived, in the middle of Coventry in Earlston until I was six, and then moved to Baggington, which for me was utopia because it's very close to Baggington Aerodrome, and in those days they held the King's Cup Air Race and the Lockheed Aerobatic Trophy at Baggington every year. My parents, or my mother, I've spoken to her recently about it, and she said they moved to Baggington because of my love of aviation, and they moved down to it June 56, and I was only 6 years old at the time, so this is obviously there before that, but I can't remember ever wanting to do anything else, never considered anything else. I don't know what I'd have done if aviation wasn't there.
So what did you join the RAF, did you?
Joined the ATC at 13, which was one of the best things I did. I think the Air Training Corps is an absolutely outstanding outfit for budding aviators to get into, because it gives a nice preview of the military, a little bit of discipline, and in some cases introduction to flying. So I learned to fly through the Air Training Corps on a flying scholarship on Cessna 150s at Carlisle, and following that learned to glide too. I applied to the Air Force to get a cadetship. It was then a RAF scholarship where they paid you through secondary school. This was at Bablick School in Coventry. I failed that because I didn't have the requisite qualifications, but they gave me a flying scholarship. I applied to British Airways and failed that because I ended up arguing with a chap on the other side of the desk in the interview board. doesn't do much for your future if you're trying to get a job with somebody, does it really? Then came to the point where I'd taken A-levels and went to see the careers man at school, and it was decided that the best place for me was the Royal Air Force. I reapplied, got in, and joined the Air Force on a university cadetship in 1969 at the age of 19, and the rest of it, as they say, is history.
And what was your path through the RAF?
Path through the RAF was
fighters, was it all?
Yes, it's Queen Mary College London, the university where I was stationed at White Waltham flying chipmunks for 3 years. Joined 11 graduate entry at Cranwell in January 1973. Passed out in 1974 and went to Valley to fly Nats. That was January through June 74. Then moved to the other side of the airfield to do a hunter course at Valley, then down to Broadie to do the tactical weapons unit course. Posted up to Lossiemouth, learned how to fly Jaguars in 1975, joined 54 Squadron in September 75 through to June 1978. Then moved back to Broadie as an instructor, initially on the Hunter and then on the Hawk, which took me to December 80. Learned French, went to France and did the French test pilot course, and passed out as a pilot d'essai numéro 398.
Or ECPS equivalent.
That's
it?
Right, yeah. In July 1982. Boscombe Down on A Squadron, which is fast jet test squadron at Boscombe, summer of 82 through to summer of 85, flying Buccaneer, Harrier C, Harrier Jaguar, Hunter Hawk, Jet Provost, and tests on one or two others. Essentially, weapon, release, carriage and jettison, and a little bit of integration on head-up displays and inertial navigation systems. A short tour in Ministry of Defence, which for me was pure purgatory. That was 8 months in flying operations. Then spring of 86 through to 89, summer of 89, at Farnborough, doing night vision systems mainly on Harrier, Buccaneer, and a little bit of work up on Varsity and Andover. Some air medical research work on Hunter and Hawk as well, high G work and pressure breathing under G. Then moved to Rolls Royce in 1989 to fly the 1161 Hawk. That's when I left the Air Force.
Yeah.
Been with Rolls Royce ever since, as fast jet test pilot from 89 through to the end of 93, and then I took over from the ex-chief test pilot, a chap called Ken Robertson, in January 94 as company test pilot stroke manager flight test, I think the title was then. Very shortly changed to head of flying because the Ministry of Defence and the Civilian Aviation Authority wouldn't accept a company test pilot as their representative for flying operations at Rolls-Royce. You need to have somebody of a certain status before they will entrust you with the flying of their aeroplanes, which I think is quite reasonable. And the title of head of flying was acceptable to both the company and the Ministry of Defence.
Going back to your school days when you were airstruck and desperately wanted to do nothing else, when you actually got in behind the controls of an aeroplane, did you find that you became a natural pilot? Did flying become easy to you in the early stages?
Yes, it did, but I never considered myself a natural pilot. I worked very hard through the PPL course that I did at Carlisle, and my first instructor, a chap called Cassimony, Captain Cassimony, I don't know his first name, I don't even know if he's still there, but he had a reputation of being a hard instructor, and I used to almost dread the flying with him. But I do remember him working me very hard, and I can remember walking out of the airplane almost in a cold sweat after the flight. And we went through two or three of these, and I thought, well, if this is what it's like, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to make it. I'll try hard, but I'm going to be lost on the way. And I remember at the end of one of the debriefs, as he was walking out the room, he said, "You're going to make a good pilot one day." And I thought, "Ah, well, perhaps there is something there after all." But it never came easy.
How long did it
hard
take
work.
To sail out?
8 hours. That's 8 hours, 5 minutes.
Well, it's about the norm, isn't it?
At the time, 7.5 hours was the average, and I changed instructors then, and I felt that I was ready for solo at about 6.5 hours, and I can remember the last hour and a half working up to those 8 hours. As each hour went by, I got more and more frustrated, more and more bored, because he should have sent me earlier, in my opinion, at the time. A bit of arrogance there, isn't there, really? But it was 8 hours, 5 minutes, yeah.
And as the performance of the aircraft you flew increased, you found you could keep pace with it? Or were you scared stiff on occasions?
The only time I've ever been scared in an aeroplane... I've never been scared in an aeroplane. I've been overstretched, and I've broken out into an adrenaline sweat several times because of situations I've got myself into when I've realised the danger that I put myself in afterwards. Or when I've flown an airplane that hasn't behaved itself properly and afterwards ended up with the shakes, but never really been frightened of it. The biggest jump for me was going from the Jet Provost Mark III to the Jet Provost Mark V, the Chipmunk up to the Jet Provost. I started on the Cessna 150, joined the Air Force, went on to the Chipmunk, they're much the same sort of thing. Then went on to the Jet Provost 3, which is a bit faster than the Chipmunk, but not much. Did some quite intensive training on the JP3 at the beginning of my wings course. And then halfway through the wings course, following a test, we hopped into the JP5. And I found for the first couple of flights, the JP5 ran away with me. But that's the only time I felt...
Was it that much more powerful?
Yes, it was. Mm. Not that much. I think the climb speed was 200 knots instead of 140. But that might not be correct. But it's something that might be 180 instead of 140. But I can remember getting airborne from Cranwell and climbing out on my solo, feeling that the aircraft was running away and having to pull myself back and sitting back a little bit more. But it didn't last very long. And that is the only time I can remember an aircraft running away in flight. On all the others, it's been relatively progressive up to the high-speed, low-level stuff. I've only gone up to about 650 knots at low level.
But at low level, you mean minimum height, what, 200 feet?
At that speed, I don't think I've been below 250 feet. but the lowest we fly on weapons dropped, weapons runs in the day that, or the lowest we flew in the days that I was in the Air Force was 100 foot. But at 100 foot, probably 450 knots maximum.
And when you went on to fly operational aircraft, I mean, what were your feelings about the different types? I mean, did you like the Hunter, for instance?
The only aircraft I flew operationally was the Jaguar. Mm-hmm. I have to say, I didn't like it at the time. I would have liked to have gone into Harrier, but I made a big mistake, and I didn't choose it. And in those days, you had to choose it to be considered. There's a little bit of underconfidence, really. I found out later in life, everybody sees their documents at some stage in the Air Force. You make sure that all the staff are out the way and then break into the safe and have a look. I discovered that during training, I'd done sufficiently well to have gone on to Harriers had I chosen it, but I didn't choose it. I chose Buccaneers, in fact, and they posted me to Jaguar. I didn't particularly like the Jaguar because it was, in my opinion, underpowered. Now I've flown the Harrier and the Buccaneer, the Jaguar, in fact, has got quite a reasonable thrust-weight ratio at operational speeds. It's also got a lot better handling qualities than the Jaguar and the Buccaneer, than the Jaguar and the Harrier. And it's a much more pleasant airplane.
So it's got better handling.
The Jaguar has got better handling characteristics than the Buccaneer and the Harrier.
In the
area where it operates. Which surprised me, but I didn't much like it because it had got small engines at the time. We weren't allowed to use the gun because it hadn't been cleared. We were still dropping 1,000-pound bombs. The cluster bomb unit had only just come into being, but we hadn't got a forward-firing weapon, and our job was on occasion to attack Russian ships, which were bristling with missiles and just about everything else. And we felt on the squadron it was a bit of a rum do because... if we ever had to attack these beasties, then we'd have to fly over the top and drop a 1940s vintage iron bomb on them. Whereas they had a whole bunch of missiles and just about everything else that they'd thrown back at us. So it
was a very happy time. You didn't have an anti-ship missile, was it? The Sea Skua or whatever?
No, not at all.
Or Sea Eagle?
No, Sea Eagle went on Buccaneer and Sea Harrier. But that wasn't until the mid-80s. The Buccaneer had Martel in the 70s. But the Jaguar, we didn't pick up the gun until about 1976, 1977, and I joined the squadron in 1975. And they didn't get anything other than 1,000-pounders and CBUs until the early 80s. I think they then introduced the rocket, Canadian rocket, the name escapes me. It'll come back to me in a minute. But the laser-guided bomb, one of the first trials I did at Boscombe Down as an embryo test pilot straight out of the French TP school was clearing the Jaguar for a laser-guided bomb on the centre line in 1982. So it didn't get the laser-guided bomb until the early 80s. Now, of course, it's a very formidable airplane because it's got a missile for self-defence, it's got a very sophisticated radar warnings and receiver, you can carry a jamming pod, a chaff dispenser, a flare dispenser, all manner of bombs, rockets.
So it's still got
guns.
Quite a bit of life ahead of it.
Yeah. Well, it's coming up for
it's
coming up for an update now, and it'll go on well into the next century. Yeah.
This is a
Jaguar. Yeah. Formidable airplane. And there's a very positive support for re-engineering with a more powerful engine, which hopefully is going to give me some flying, fast jet flying in about 12 months' time.
Because it had a very bad reputation for stalling characteristics, didn't it?
It killed a lot of people,
yeah.
No doubt about it. I lost some very dear friends in the 1970s on the airplane. I went through Lossiemouth on the sixth course in April through September 1975. The course after me were four people, and within a couple of years, three of them were dead. The fourth chap ended up on Hercules. He's still in the Air Force now in 1998.
What was the problem? How was it cured? I mean, was it a simple problem?
Several aspects of it. The aircraft have got very nasty stall characteristics, which caught some people out. In that, if you go beyond the limiting instance, the aircraft handling qualities were fine until it reached its own limit, and then without warning, it would depart. modern aircraft don't spin. They quote, depart from control flight, unquote. And when the Jaguar departs from control flight, there's very little you can do about it. There's one instance of a chap who mistook the slat switch for the air brake switch doing an attack on a North German airfield, a practice attack during a deployment we had from Coldeshall to Tirstrup in Denmark in 1976. And he approached the attack nominally to do a toss manoeuvre, pull up and launch a bomb, which would then travel about 3 miles because it was launched at 45 degrees or so, and then do a breakoff manoeuvre. The running speed was 500 knots, the slat limiting speed was 500 knots, but you need your slats for manoeuvre. So we would run in at 500 knots with the slats in. As we started the manoeuvre, we'd hit the slat button to put the slats out, allowing better manoeuvre control and better margin away from this departure because of the slats. He unfortunately, or when they found the wreckage, the air brake was out and the slat was in, so it's assumed that he hit the wrong button because both the slat and the air brake button are on the throttle, very close to each other. It was assumed that he hit the air brake button and put the air brakes out rather than the slats, so not only had he lost the effect of the slats on his ability to manoeuvre, he lost energy because he'd got his air brakes out. And as he was pulling into his recovery manoeuvre, the aircraft reached limiting instance, departed, rolled underneath and spread him over the concrete at Eggebeck. You can look for several reasons for that. When I went through the Jaguar course, on my particular squadron, a lot of people were scrubbed, but very few people were killed subsequently. So the conclusion that we come to, and it's not one that really one could publicise or one would like to be publicised, but the conclusion that we came to at the time was that it's better to be chopped in training because you're not of sufficient standard than to have it done by natural selection later on. But one has to be very careful when you make statements like that, obviously.
Yes, the obverse of that is, of course, that the Jaguar was a difficult aeroplane to fly.
Yes. Well, it wasn't difficult to fly. It required a little bit more, perhaps a little bit more thought as to what it would do, because within its cleared envelope, it was benign as anything. Absolutely no problem at all. But once you hit the limit of the cleared envelope, it was a killer. Therefore, you had to fly it within the cleared envelope. Now, if that requires more skill, then that's what it required. But really, it required an attitude of mind to have the pilot ensure that he flew it within the cleared envelope and not to get sidelined on anything else. Now, there's another aspect of it, was the head-up display and weapon system. It was one of the first aircraft with a head-up display. The Harrier was the other one. With an instrumentation system, in the head-up display, which gave you attitude, heading, and height indications. It was prone to failure, and certain insidious failures could come along that gave false information. And if you relied on that false information, you'd end up crashing. And there were several crashes occurred where guys pulled up into cloud and were next seen about 30 seconds later coming out of cloud in a dive and powered straight into the ground. And it was assumed that it was an insidious failure of the head-up display instrument, which they hadn't noticed. So again, the pilot had to force himself to cross-refer instrument systems. Although you use your head-up display to fly the airplane, it meant you had to look at both the head-up display and the head-down display and compare the two. And if there's a discrepancy, you've got to decide which one's good and then follow that one. Now, if he hasn't got an ability to do that, then he's going to crash. So if having that ability means the aircraft's difficult or it requires a better pilot, then yes. But I don't believe that's the case. I think it's, if you train the guy properly, if he doesn't accept the training, then he's out. But if you train him properly, you should be able to do both of those and you should be able to survive it.
How about the Harrier in contrast?
Harrier is different. The Harrier requires certain skills that are different to those required to fly a conventional aeroplane. Very similar to the Jaguar in the hover, in that the hover has very hard boundaries. If you transgress them, then you lose the aeroplane and probably lose the pilot as well. and there's very little warning when you get to that boundary. You can liken it to sitting on a plateau of, say, 100 yards square, blindfolded with a walking stick, and just walk around the plateau and at a fast walking pace, using the walking stick to find your way. And if you start in the middle and just walk in very tight circles, you'll always be safe. But if you walk around randomly, at some point you'll almost certainly come to the edge of the plateau and fall off it before you can stop. And the hover's very much like that, in that it's very benign in the middle of the envelope, and it spreads out like that in all directions. But you come to a point where you can reach the limit very quickly. There's been one or two examples of guys in air shows reversing the airplane at high speed in the hover, doing what they call a backup RVL, where you put the aircraft into reverse, if you like, go backwards at a certain speed, then at some point lower the nose, which causes the tail to rise, or vice versa. The aircraft will climb slightly, stop, because you're creating a flat plate to the airflow, relative airflow, and you're also putting the engine efflux backwards because you're putting the nose down, which will arrest your rearward motion. The aircraft will start to slide down towards the ground, and then it's flared and put on the ground at about 50 knot ground speed, which is rolling vertical landing, and that's why it's called a backup RVL. The danger of that manoeuvre is if you go backwards too quickly, when you lower the nose by pushing the control column forward, you open the rear puffer jet, which pushes the tail up, but also you raise the elevators. And if you're going backwards at a sufficient speed, the elevators will act as a canard and create positive lift, which will cause the tail to rise even quicker. I'm sorry, the other way around. Let's start that again. If you pull the stick back, push the stick forward, you cause the tail to rise because of the puffer at the back. But by pushing the stick forward, you put the elevators down. If you start a sufficient nose-down couple going because of the rear puffer and the nose starts to go down, it may go down at such a rate as to overcome the tailplane. And if you then pull the stick back to try and arrest the nose going down, you'll present the elevator as a canard, and the elevator will be up, and it'll cause the tail to raise even quicker, which will overcome the puffers by this stage because you've got significant incidence on them, and the aircraft will nose over. So even though you've got the stick back trying to raise the nose, the canard effect of the tail will cause the nose to go down, and that's killed a couple of guys during airshow practice. So it's not a difficult airplane. It requires a different...
You've got to keep the nose into wind, haven't you, in the hover? Or isn't that necessary?
Don't have to at all. There's a problem as the aircraft is decelerated from... How are we doing on that? As the aircraft is decelerated from less than about 100 knots or so, then it becomes unstable in yaw. If we can imagine the aircraft... If the aircraft is tracking directly towards a point and the fuselage is aligned with the direction it's going, then there's absolutely no problem. But if the fuselage moves to one side, let's say the aircraft is pointing to the left, but we're still tracking towards the same point, so the airflow will be coming from the right. And as the airflow enters the intake, its direction is changed. And if we take an equal and opposite reaction to that, that forces the nose to go to the left even more, which leads to pulling the aircraft away from the direction that it's going. As you go through 100 knots, the correcting effect of the fin rudder is reduced, and we come to a point at around 80, 70 knots or so where the aircraft is yaw unstable as it's approaching the hover. Now, it's got a very good set of order stabs which control that. In the early marks, where there was no order stabilisation going into the hover, or in the later marks, if the auto stabilisation fails, then we have to control the yaw physically by the pilot. You can't just let the aircraft come into the hover on its own, otherwise you'll end up 90 degrees to the direction you're going in. Excuse me. If we have yaw on the aircraft as we're coming into the hover and we put instance on it, then we get a rolling effect from the swept wings. if we put significant incidents and significant yaw, the roll will be such that it will overpower the roll puffers. So even if we put full opposite aileron, as we were coming into this situation, the roll yaw the roll couple due to the yaw and the incidence is greater, and the aircraft will roll it onto its back and crash. And that, I think, is the phenomenon that you're talking about.